Hey there, fellow travelers. Welcome to the Tolkien Road, episode 266, Tolkien Takes on Narnia. In this episode, we'll be exploring Tolkien's opinion of C.S. Lewis's Narnia Chronicles. Did he really despise his dear friend's famous fantasy series? You'll soon find out. I'm excited to be joined on this episode by Holly Ordway, the author of Tolkien's Modern Reading, as well as David Bates, host of Pints with Jack, the C.S. Lewis podcast. Holly and David, welcome to the show.
Hello.
It's wonderful to be back again.
Awesome. It's wonderful to have both of you all back. So before we dive in, I'd like to give a big shout out to our amazing fellowship of patrons and special thanks to this episode's executive producers, Andrew T., John R., Ms. Anonymous, Red Hawk, and Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien. Please support the Tolkien Road by visiting patreon.com/Tolkien Road. Becoming a patron lets you support the show in a tangible way and land you some awesome perks. All right. So it's fairly common knowledge at this point that J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis were close friends. From their first meeting in the mid-1920s through the major portion of their literary and academic careers, the two exerted enormous influence on one another. And while C.S. Lewis also famously heaped praise upon The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, many have heard that Tolkien held Narnia in disdain. So is that true? Did Tolkien have some strange dislike for Narnia? And if so, why? And so that's really why I've brought Holly and David here today. David has been, you know, deep diving into C.S. Lewis in kind of the same way that we have been deep diving into Tolkien for, you know, these last several years. And Holly is the author of Tolkien's Modern Reading, which is a book that came out earlier this year and really does a great job of, there's David holding it up for us. It does such a fantastic job of really providing a critical review of Tolkien's literary tastes. And it's pretty amazing how well it dispels some things that aren't quite accurate. Some things that have kind of become common knowledge of what Tolkien thought about this or that. And we find out that, wait a minute, maybe that's not as accurate as we thought it was. So Holly, in Tolkien's Modern Reading, you give an overview of the sources for Tolkien's opinion of Narnia. Can you give us a little bit about, like, just your take on what the common knowledge of his view of Narnia is and what you, the sources you found for this view?
Well, the main source for the idea that Tolkien despised Narnia comes from his authorized biographer, Humphrey Carpenter, who says that he just hated it, that he rejected everything about it. And so I want to say to everybody out there who took this as true, it's perfectly reasonable to accept that, because that is, after all, his biographer. You would think that this would be accurate. But as I was doing my research for Tolkien's Modern Reading, I kept finding indications that Carpenter's presentation was not quite as accurate or as unbiased as we might wish. I mean, I have an entire book on his Modern Reading. It's quite a thick book. And Carpenter said that he took no serious notice of any modern literature. And I thought, well, this is obviously not the case. This is factually incorrect. And this led me to start thinking to myself, I shouldn't just take Carpenter's word for it that he hated Narnia, because he Carpenter in the biography and then in his group biography, The Inklings, goes into quite a lot of detail about how he even says that his dislike of Narnia was a key factor in his cooling of friendship with Lewis, which is a pretty big claim. Mm-hmm. So I thought, this is a big deal. What's the evidence? We have just a conversation shared between, recounted by Roger Lancelin Green about Tolkien commenting on Narnia and saying, well, I can give you the actual quote. He says that, oh, I hear you've been reading Jack's children's story. It really won't do, you know. I mean to say, nymphs and their ways, the love life of a faun. Doesn't he know what he's talking about? And that's what we have for evidence. And I thought to myself, let me go back and try to find out where can we get any closer to it, to what he actually thought. And I traced back all the way back, for instance, to this tiny, very difficult to find monograph by Roger Lancelin Green about C.S. Lewis, an article he wrote in 1974, all these different sources. And I found that the closer you got to the time of Tolkien's alleged dislike of Narnia, the less heeded were the reports. And it turns out that he didn't particularly care for it, based on the little that he had heard or read. We don't actually know if he read the whole book. We only know that he had some of the couple chapters that he read in manuscripts. So he made some snarky comments to Green about one particular aspect of the first couple of chapters. That's what we have for the direct evidence of he hated Narnia. And he comments later in some other context that he didn't approve of the way that Lewis had mixed in different mythologies. That we can talk about that later, but that's not the same thing as just despising the whole thing. So I was a bit sort of rocked back, and I realized this whole thing has been a giant game of telephone. Everybody has just taken one step more, and from didn't particularly like it has become he hated it so much that it destroyed their friendship. Let's back away from this a little bit.
Right. Well, and you know, one of the things that you know that I feel like from reading your book and the other parts of your book, this seems to be kind of a recurring theme, is like something that Humphrey Carpenter said in his biography. Maybe it's not quite so accurate. And there's even reason to kind of look back at it all, as valuable as that work is, and say, you know, maybe he had some other motives kind of going on here, and he kind of told the story in a certain way, you know, in a certain biased way that needs to be acknowledged. And that's, you know, again, that's kind of another reason that when one arrives at this point in the book, in your book, they might say to themselves, yeah, maybe I do have this thing about Lewis or Tolkien and his, you know, utter hatred for Narnia. Maybe I'm all wrong about that, you know?
Yeah, and it's interesting because it's quite a big change of mental, sort of a mental shift, because it's really well entrenched that he hated Narnia. And so what a sort of sad thing that the creator of Narnia and Middle Earth couldn't like each other's work. And it is interesting to realize that, you know, Carpenter in his biography and in the Inklings Group biography, I mean, he goes into kind of an in-depth psychologizing of he suggests, for instance, that Tolkien was jealous of the speed of the production of the Narnia Chronicles. And I started thinking about this in terms of chronology, and I realized that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense, because the Narnia Chronicles were Lewis's first venture into children's fiction. Mm-hmm. And Tolkien had already written a blockbuster success in The Hobbit. So he had no reason to be jealous of the Narnia Chronicles, because at that point they were just Jack's little side project. Now we know they were massively successful. So even if he were prone to jealousy, at that point he had nothing to be jealous of. It was the other way around. He was the one with the smash hit in The Hobbit. And Tolkien's big critique of everything was, it's not careful enough. It's not fully worked out enough. There aren't languages. There aren't all these depths of history. The phases of the moon aren't matching with the chronology of the journey. That's the kind of thing that bugged Tolkien. So if anything, he would have been disappointed that they weren't done so quickly, not jealous. So that was one of the indications when I read Carpenter's account more closely. I thought to myself, where is he getting this? This doesn't even make sense in light of Tolkien's personality. And then I started looking more carefully. This is all just supposition. And unfortunately, because he doesn't cite his sources, when you can't quite tell when he's paraphrasing something that Tolkien said versus just making up things based on his own interpretation. So I've learned, again, there are useful things in Carpenter biography, but he really has such a blend of interpretation that I now am very, very cautious about going with what he says without double and triple checking it.
And this also isn't the first time that something like this has happened. We've had Dr. Diana Glyer on our show, and one of the main myths that she explodes is the idea that the Inklings didn't influence each other. Fortunately, that has now pretty much been put to rest. John, you said yourself at the beginning how the influence that they had on each other, we now clearly accept that. But this was something that Carpenter put forward, that no, they were these lone artists, and the quotation was brought out, you know, influence Tolkien, you might as well try and influence a Bandersnatch.
Yeah.
And well, Dyer's work is so important in that respect. I mean, it was really important for me because, again, she goes into it in such detail and just explodes it.
Yeah.
It just completely exploded.
Yeah. Well, and so there's some other sources for this as well, right? So we have Carpenter. You mentioned Green. I believe you have a quotation in here from Walter Hooper as well, which speaks to, kind of gets us started on that trail of like where Tolkien's own, what was his actual opinion and, you know, what was he getting at? You know, did he have some criticisms? I mean, is it completely off base that he was not a fan, you know, or that he didn't like the Narnia Chronicles, or is there some truth to that? In your professional opinion, where does the evidence all land in all of this? What was Tolkien's actual view?
I think as far as we can tell, again, from the snippets that we have, I think he didn't care for them, and I think by the end of his life, he had a sort of guardedly positive view. It's very interesting, this quote, it's not included in the letters, but another author, Josh Long, found it, that Tolkien later in life called the Chronicles deservedly very popular.
Mm-hmm.
And that deservedly is significant because, you know, that they were popular at that point was simply a fact. But to say the deservedly popular means that he saw there was something of value. Now, in that same letter, he says that he doesn't care for them. But, you know, and then elsewhere, he says that they're outside the range of his imaginative sympathy. And I think that's a phrase that is really important to note, because that's not the same thing as saying that they're not good. Mm-hmm. It's just that he himself doesn't resonate with them. Fair enough.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I will say for myself, and, David might come at me through the camera here, but as someone who grew up and loving the Chronicles of Narnia since discovering Middle Earth, I still appreciate them, but they're not as quite as number one in my, my estimation as they might've been. Right. There is, there's room for taste in all this. I have plenty of friends who just don't understand my obsession with Tolkien, right. You know, that just don't get it. And I try to explain it to them. And I know there's, at the end of the day, there's no use. Do I have reasons for that? Of course, we all have our reasons, for our tastes. So
there's a quotation from Lewis in The Four Loves that the human mind prefers to praise and dispraise rather than define and describe. The idea that we always want to rank everything. You can't say that one poet is good without comparing it to another and putting them in order as though they're about to win a prize. And I think that's where a lot of this comes from. When we come to reading about the Inklings with this kind of mindset, well, if Tolkien didn't like it, then he must have hated them. There must be nothing good. But one of the things that Holly shows in her book was that Tolkien read widely. Mm-hmm. He didn't agree with all of it. There were authors that he enjoyed their writing, but thought some of their philosophies behind them were evil. So he could still praise things that had aspects that he really liked. And I think that quotation about the Chronicles of Narnia being deservedly well praised is because he could see that there was value in there, even if there were elements in it that he didn't like, that he wouldn't have chosen, and that he probably thought Jack should have changed.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. Your comment about ranking things was so funny to me because my youngest is 12 years old, and he is just like obsessed with the like videos on YouTube of like people ranking like the best like guitar players of all time or something like that, right? And so he'll just every day he'll ask me like five different variations on the question of like, hey Dad, what do you think like the five greatest guitar players of all time are? And I'm just like, I mean, I get it because at his age, I loved those questions too, right? But now I'm like, I don't know. I'd have to like think about that. And like, it's like I'd have to do like a critical analysis of it. And it's just like, it's almost so that almost made me think of like there's kind of this way in which it's like a childish or immature the kind of take to be like just, the ranking system, right, in our minds versus Tolkien later on in life saying, I may not be much of a fan of this, but I can appreciate that this is a work that has merit that's maybe not to my liking, but for a lot of other people, it really resonates with them. You know, and I think I give that answer to some variation of that answer to my son quite often. I'm like, yeah, you know, not so much a fan of that particular artist, but I can see why people are into them. You know, it's, they're very talented and they, you know, really great guitar player, you know.
And are we also really that surprised that men who are steeped in literary criticism had criticisms for literature? You know, yeah. They didn't love everything, even things that they love. I remember when we were dating, Marie would always comment that I always had my improvements to the movie that we just watched, right. How, what I would have changed. And I remember at the end of one movie, she said, all right, what would you have done differently? And partly that's just the way that I'm wired. And when you read about the Inklings, that's clearly how they were wired as well. Some of the descriptions of their meetings, I think it's in Warnie's diary, he says, if people didn't know that we were friends, they think this massive fight was happening. But they saw this criticism of one another as a means of improving the texts that they were presenting to one another.
Absolutely. Well, and Holly, you write about this later in the book, and I believe it's chapter 9. One of the things that I think a lot of people hear that Tolkien was not a fan of Narnia, and it's like scandalous to them, right? It's like wait a minute, how could he betray his friend like that? You know, it's like, you know, and it's like, you know, it's almost like it's this like slight, you know, to Lewis, right? This attack on Lewis, and that's maybe where this like kind of sensationalism of it comes from. But the truth is that the main fictional works that Lewis had written before the Chronicles of Narnia, being the Space Trilogy, Tolkien was actually a pretty big fan of. He actually like praised those books and enjoyed them.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is huge because he was a huge fan of the Ransom Trilogy.
The Ransom Trilogy.
Yeah, I'm one of the people who says I know it's the Ransom Trilogy or the Cosmic Trilogy. I'm pedantic like Tolkien. So he, you know, he read Out of the Silent Planet. Loved it, and helped Lewis get it published. And he has a long letter to the publisher, Stanley Unwin, in which he just lavishes praise on the book. And, in the aims of getting it, helping to get it published, he loved Perelandra, didn't care as much for That Hideous Strength. That Hideous Strength is very different in flavor than the first two. A lot of people have different views of it. It's for me, it's my favorite of the three, but
I should say that's, I can kind of see where Tolkien and why I've latched onto Tolkien so much. Cause that's kind of how I am. I'm like Out of the Silent Planet, Perelandra. Yes. Those are awesome. Like those are amazing books. And I'm like Hideous Strength. I'm like, what is this? And people keep telling me, you need to go back and read That Hideous Strength. And I was like, I'm going to go back and read it. I'm going to go back and read it today. I had that resolution in my mind. Anyway, I'm sorry, Holly.
Yeah. But I mean, I think this is important. No, again, different tastes. It's entirely legitimate to have different preferences here. But I do think it's very much worth noting that it wasn't the case that Tolkien simply didn't like the things that Lewis wrote in fiction. Because as I said, he really loved, the first two of his science fictional books, and like lavishly praised them, and talks about them, and is thrilled that his daughter Priscilla is enjoying them. I mean, he's really enthusiastic. So we're not talking about somebody who's just like icy cold about his friend's works. But I want to come back to a point, you know, that David made about the Inklings meetings, because I think this is something that gets overlooked. It's that Tolkien's personality, he's one of the things I discovered in my research for Tolkien Modern Reading is how many of his friends, the people who really spent time with him, talked about him having a really hyperbolic personality, that he was theatrical, that he loved almost to play a role, that he would pretend like he was angry, and then 2 minutes later he would be, you know, having a relaxed conversation. He had a real streak of the theatrical in him. We see this in those Inklings meetings where they're, you know, kind of play acting this, you know, this huge argument. And he's also English. And
careful. Yes.
And though I am not myself English, in the last decade, I've spent so much time in England that I have come to notice that, well, the English are different from Americans. And one of the things that the English do is they use language differently. Self-deprecation, mirror talk, understatement. There's an element of that in English habits of speech that often Americans simply don't recognize. So I remember years and years ago, I tried teaching on fairy stories to a bunch of undergraduates, and I hit a brick wall because the opening of it is him saying, you know, far be it from me, a mere amateur, to talk about this, you know, this subject. And my students were basically saying, why are we reading this if he doesn't know what he's talking about? And of course, as an Englishman, he is saying, I'm a world-class expert in this, and you all know it, and I know it, and I know that you know it, so let's move on. So this kind of combination of, you know, this playfulness, this self-deprecation, mm-hmm. I think you see that. And then you look at that comment that I read at the beginning of our conversation where he says, it really won't do, you know. I mean, to say nymphs in their ways, the love life of a fawn, doesn't he know what he's talking about? If you put that in the context of his playfulness, of his, you know, his chaffing his friends, all of a sudden it takes on a very different tone. He's mm-hmm. not slamming Narnia. He's just engaging with it in the way that they intended to do. In cold print, out of context, it can look like a condemnation that I have no doubt that it was playfully said. It was a genuine criticism, but playfully said.
Well, and to that point, you know, we think of when Lewis, you know, Lewis has some very famous publicized, like intentionally published comments about The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. His review of The Hobbit is like kind of well known for, you know, maybe having really launched The Hobbit into, you know, the stratosphere, right? When it came out. And he obviously, you know, there's the very famous sayings that he has about Lord of the Rings that were all publicized. So it's important, I think, maybe to realize that all of these little tidbits of information that we have about Tolkien's views of Narnia were never intended by him to be published. It wasn't like he was writing, you know, writing essays or, you know, opinion pieces, you know, why Narnia is horrible, right? You know, why disdain Narnia or something like that. These are little snippets that he was offering in private conversation with various individuals about his friend's work, you know, in this particular case.
So they weren't prepared statements. They were said with pints in their hands and right. A bunch of dudes. Have you hung out with a bunch of dudes? How much positive and affirming things do they really say to each other's faces? Very little.
It can sometimes feel like if you're not, you know, it's like intentionally putting one another down, that you're not really, you know, you're not really affirming one, right?
Exactly.
You're not really a part of the group. Yeah. At least it can feel like that sometimes. No, great point. So Holly, you talk, I think there's some interesting things you bring out about Tolkien's own works in juxtaposition with, you know, maybe his view of Narnia. And so, you know, what are some of the things that, what are some of the reasons that you uncovered for why Tolkien held these opinions? You know, it wasn't just this like general thing necessarily, but there were kind of specific reasons that you uncovered for why Tolkien felt this way about Narnia. And there's also some interesting things you found about that kind of are like, well, aren't you doing the same things in certain ways, Tolkien?
Yeah, we'll have to come back to the Father Christmas letters because that's just fascinating. But I think one thing that Tolkien held very high was the virtue of consistency. Mm-hmm. And indeed, mm-hmm. I think he could get a little bit obsessive about it. And that was probably one of the reasons why he just didn't finish things, is he just got really obsessive about making sure all the details were absolutely consistent. And honestly, if I had a time travel machine, I might, you know, want to use it to go back and say, Tolkien, relax. It's okay if it's not entirely clear how astronomy works in the Silmarillion. Like, no one is going to, well, maybe like five people out of a million are going to care. But really,
oh, come on, there are entire societies that would pull him up on it.
Well, this is true. But he was just that was a very big thing. And even I was intrigued to find that he became dissatisfied with The Hobbit, mm-hmm. his own book, because he called it a rabble. Because he had drawn in all these different sources, and, you know, the runes are actually Anglo-Saxon runes that translate into English. And he's, oh, that's just really ridiculous. So he's critical, I think, of Narnia using different mythological elements, but he's critical of everything that does that, mm-hmm. Except The Wind in the Willows. So I think that's an interesting inconsistency that highlights his overall general consistency, that he just likes things to be systematized. And that's not how Narnia is. And right. I think it's useful to think of a comment that Michael Ward makes in Planet Narnia when he's talking about Lewis and Tolkien. He says, we have to allow these two men to do different things in their own ways. It's too common that we sort of assume that because they have certain similarities, they're doing all the same things and they're doing them in the same way. When that's not the case. Tolkien has different priorities and they don't map onto Lewis's priorities. And that's okay.
Yeah. Well, we see that big time in this The Nature of Middle Earth, which, you know, of course came out a few months ago. I mean, Tolkien seems to have spent the last few decades of his life trying to systematize Middle Earth. You know, it's almost like he's writing the Summa Theologica for Middle Earth, for crying out loud. I mean, that's how he worked. That's how his view of what he was doing evolved over the course of his life. It's funny because I've been reading Roverandom actually for the first time. I tried it a few years ago and could not make a good start on it, but we're going to cover that here, you know, in a few episodes on the podcast. And that story predates The Hobbit. That story goes back to the mid 1920s. And I just find myself reading this and be like, this is like that mishmash. And it's like a Shaggy Dog story too. You know, it's like, it's just, this has no, like the later Tolkien seemed, I have to feel like would have hated this, you know, to go back and like, you know, for him to read it later on, it might be like, yeah, that's something I wrote a long time ago. Kind of glad they didn't publish it, even though I offered it to them to be published. So it's, you know, I mean, Tolkien was definitely an individual whose own views evolved over time. And that consistency thing does seem to have been very, you know, very key for him.
Except in one area, I wonder.
Yeah.
Tom Bombadil. You know, he comes in from earlier stories that he told his kids, and we see this growing almost OCD with Tolkien as he gets older, that everything has to be systemized and well thought out and backgrounds explained. Yet in that one instance, silence.
Right.
I just wonder if he just couldn't help himself.
One of these days, somebody's going to find like a lost essay from Tolkien on like the true nature of Tom Bombadil. Here's who Tom Bombadil really was, and the universe is going to implode.
But I think that's an instance of like, you know, he's got sort of different creative forces in his own psyche. He has the tremendously, you know, generative creative impulse, and then he has this massive systematizing impulse. And you know, when the two interact, they can produce, you know, marvelous things, because the systematizing of the languages is really, in his own words, what produced his fiction, you know, The Lord of the Rings. And yet we see some places where the creative impulse, I think, pushes past the systematizing. And so we get Tom Bombadil. It's fascinating. And I do think you're right in this, David, that in his later years, he does become a little bit more fixed in the way that he's thinking about things. Again, you know, he lived to be 82, and we compare him to Lewis, who died at 63. You know, we tend to forget too that, you know, Tolkien had, you know, 20 more years of you know, writing and thinking and, you know, and
editing.
An older man. Yeah, so I mean, I think we also have to take into account that it's quite natural, I think, for one to have your patterns kind of more fixed toward the end of your life. But you can't then transpose that back on his creative period and say, well, that's how he did things from the beginning. Because as you say, with Roverandom, it wasn't that way.
Oh yeah, the evolution in his storytelling style over time was incredible. I mean, it went from one completely different thing to another. It still bears similar marks, but it's just evolved so much. And one of the things that I'm reminded of, I can't remember if we brought this up yet, but Tolkien's like initial reactions to Narnia would have been in the late 1940s, just as he's ending this decade long period of composing the new Hobbit, right, which became the Lord of the Rings. And he had gone through this whole wrestling process of not being happy. Does he really want to write a sequel to this book that he wasn't really happy with? in review, and like a lot of On Fairy Stories you mentioned earlier, a lot of On Fairy Stories is kind of him like looking back at that process or in the midst of the process of writing The Hobbit, and his views are actually evolving there to be more like what he was going to do in Lord of the Rings. But he's looking back at this period and he's like, he's gone through this vast evolution and what he wants to create. And then here's Lewis creating something that's more like The Hobbit, right? That's a little bit more like The Hobbit, you know, right there. So we can also see how, you know, he would have been like, oh, been there, done that, you know, like, you know, to some degree. David, I wanted to ask you, I've heard you make some interesting comments because there's about what Narnia is and what Lewis saw himself doing with Narnia in the past. And I wanted to give you a chance to revisit those. I think people, and I know I've repeated this often, people often say that, well, you know, Narnia, one of the things I've heard people say, including myself, Tolkien disliked Narnia because he disliked allegory, which was very clear. Right. Mm-hmm. And you're like, wait a minute, Narnia isn't actually allegory. So can you tell us a little bit more about what Lewis actually saw himself doing with Narnia?
Sure. This gets very complicated, particularly if you read what Tolkien had to say on the subject of allegory, but we'll get to that in a moment. As far as Lewis was concerned, Narnia is a supposal. It's a what if. What if the second person of the Trinity created a world like Narnia, and what if he created this world of talking beasts and he then stepped into it himself? What would that be like? That is pretty much what Narnia is, and it's meant to be a vehicle. He talks about this to his Anglican nun friend, Sister Penelope, that when he wrote the Ransom trilogy, well, Out of the Silent Planet specifically, he was shocked that people didn't realize what he was doing behind it, that he was addressing deeper theological and philosophical points, and it went over everyone's head. And he said, ah, well, I now see I've got this means of getting past people's watchful dragons. So I can basically put a pair of spectacles on them, allow them to look through my worldview, to encounter something of Christianity and the gospel, but without those stained glass associations. So that was his big point behind Narnia. Supposal, what if, and a means of investigating spiritual ideas. The question of allegory gets much more complicated because it's a word with a lot of semantic range. What do you mean when you say allegory? Even Tolkien himself said that he despised allegory in all its forms, yet my favorite of all of his works is clearly an allegory, Leaf by Niggle. Mm-hmm. You've had Michael Jahosky on this show, and in his book, he talks about it much more in terms of a spectrum, a continuum, from a very simple allegory, a one-to-one correspondence. So we're thinking of something like The Pilgrim's Progress here, where you meet people and their name is what they represent. You know, it's not hidden at all. It's very clearly being spelled
out. On the nose,
On the nose, exactly. And then you've got a complete spectrum of that all the way through metaphor, where the words and the imageries that you're using are evocative of other things, but it's not simply that the author is really telling you this other story, but just using a code. Mm-hmm.
Gotcha. Yeah. And so, Holly, I wanted to come back to The Wind in the Willows. Tolkien had it, and I've mentioned before, like I really love Wind in the Willows. Read it again this year. It had been a little while, but read it again this year. Loved it just as much. So much to appreciate about that work. Some would say that Wind in the Willows and The Chronicles of Narnia, even though they, you know, one of them is like kind of more high adventure, meaning Narnia, Wind in the Willows is kind of unclassifiable. but some would say that like, that these works are very similar and that they both feature, you know, very prominently talking beasts and this sort of thing. You know, all of the like kind of, English, you know, English trappings, you know, that so many of us appreciate so much. Tolkien seems to have very much liked Wind in the Willows. And then, as we've established, maybe not so much Narnia. What's with that? What do you see there?
Well, I think this is such an interesting question, because I think Tolkien, in theory, as we've talked about, he definitely valued consistency very highly. But he was also a reader with a great sensitivity to what he read. And so he didn't just rigidly categorize things. He was able to enjoy a lot of different things. And he absolutely loved Wind in the Willows. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. He notes that the one chapter that kind of stands out that he says almost spoils it is the chapter with the god Pan. And that is different. It's the most theological of any of the chapters in Wind in the Willows. It does have a different flavor. And he says it almost spoils it. Now, it doesn't, Ebony doesn't spoil it, but it is interesting that that's the one place where it seems to have slightly pushed into his, okay, we're mixing the streams a little bit too much here. This is too much. But when comparing the two, I think it also has to do with the specifics of the different stories. Because in Wind in the Willows, I mean, partly it's partaking of the beast fable. And Tolkien, as a medievalist, would have known that the beast fable has a lot of wiggle room in terms of what goes on in it. It's also set in the Oxfordshire countryside, which he loves. There's all these things he loves about it. If you look at the first couple of chapters of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which are what really kind of pushed his buttons, there's a blending not just of genres, but of different periods of literature, because you've got the classical with the modern. Okay, that's weird. We've got the White Witch, which is a figure straight out of Hans Christian Andersen, who, by the way, Tolkien didn't like. So we've got this Hans Christian Andersen, that's not my thing. He didn't like the intrusion of Father Christmas. And it's interesting to know that even Roger Lancelin Green, who was like Lewis's biggest fan, like Narnia, this is the best book ever. Even Roger Lancelin Green tried to convince Lewis to take Father Christmas out because, like, what's going on? It's a little baffling at first. Like, how can you have Father Christmas when you don't? Why is it not Father Aslan Mass or something? Like, right. Wait, what? And it's just your readers should read Planet Narnia, Michael Ward's Planet Narnia. He really, I think, goes into what actually Lewis is doing there. But again, on a first read, first encounter, what the heck? And then I think, and this is something I unpack in my chapter, I actually think that the specific thing he mentions, the love life of a fawn, this just won't do, is really significant. Mm-hmm. Because if you look at Mr. Tumnus and Lucy, and you keep in mind, Tolkien doesn't know how the story ends because he's only reading the first couple of chapters. Fawns in classical literature, as Tolkien and Lewis both knew very well, are associated with sexual violence. Mm-hmm. So you have a figure associated with rape and seduction, inviting the little girl into his home to have a tea. And we know that he has bad intentions. Now, he doesn't carry them out, but he still has bad intentions. And there's even, in the published version, there's even the suggestive detail of Lucy, that must be the door to his bedroom. Mm. Now, to an adult reader who knows what fawns are, this could very easily be like, remember, Lewis does not have children. Tolkien has a daughter.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think, and it's interesting because the titles that he notes in his comment, the love life of a fawn, that doesn't appear in the published version. Now, Lewis didn't keep his drafts, so we don't know this. It might have been that Tolkien was just off the cuff inventing some titles. I think it's at least possible, and I think probable, that Lewis was playfully putting in those titles as a kind of an in-joke for, to the adult reader. And Tolkien thought, whoa, this is icky for a children's book.
Yeah.
And you know what? I think he's right. And I think Lewis, he takes out, if he did, but in any case, those details aren't, those suggestive books aren't in the published version. And of course, when we see the whole story, we know that Mr. Tumnus turns out to be good. And I think it's notable that in Prince Caspian, Lewis directly addresses the question of Bacchus. And, the girls are saying, I don't think I'd feel safe with them if Aslan wasn't here. So in a way, I'm tended to think that Tolkien's criticism, hey, Jack, you're overplaying the fawn stuff. It's a little too racy for a children's book. I think Lewis assimilated that. And we see that in Prince Caspian. And I think it's a legitimate criticism.
That is just really interesting. And it almost makes me wonder if almost that was like the, just having read maybe, this early draft of it with that detail in it. And Tolkien was so just put off by that particular detail, not knowing how the story kind of turns out. Right. If that was just like, no, thank you, I don't want, not in the sense of like, you know, expecting it to become this like horrible thing from his friend, but like in the sense of just like, just kind of behind the back of his mind, turned him off to it, you know, to the whole prospect of these books. I guess, I mean, ultimately we'll never know, but it's, it's interesting, I guess, theory or hypothesis or whatever you want to call it. I guess theory, because can't really test it in the way we test a hypothesis, but, gosh,
I hadn't read The Wind in the Willows for years until I was reading through Holly's book, and I had forgotten the reaction that I had to that book. I loved the early chapters. I loved the stuff with Mr. Toad as he's driving around and boop, boop, and, boating on the river. But I had forgotten my reaction to the section about Pan. I did not like it as a child. It was weird. It was scary. And perhaps it's also something of the fact that that is retained in the book, that Tolkien is going to give it a little bit more of a pass, whereas Mr. Tumnus, there isn't that indication. There's the subtlest of things in the text that maybe he doesn't have the best of intentions. But in The Wind in the Willows, Pan is still kind of scary, at least to a small child.
Yeah. Well, and I didn't actually read Wind in the Willows until until I was in college, I think. And so I remember that was actually like one of my most favorite chapters. I was just like, whoa, this is taking this book to a whole new, like, this is amazing. You know, just the description of it, the numinous quality of it all. Like, I was just like, whoa, I haven't read this in many, I haven't seen this kind of thing, you know, really depicted successfully in a book before, but it was powerful. So Holly, you mentioned, that we wanted to come back to the Father Christmas letters. We talked about Father Christmas, Lewis's Father Christmas, and the problems. I will say with that it does, that is maybe the most jarring aspect. And as someone who truly loves, who does truly love the Narnia Chronicles, loves The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, I always do chuckle whenever Father Christmas comes into it, because it just seems, of all the elements, it seems the most like, okay, there's Father Christmas. But tell us about Tolkien's Father Christmas letters and why they, why they're interesting in this discussion.
Well, the Father Christmas letters are a set of illustrated letters that he wrote to his children over 20 years. And they're amazing. They've now been collected in their entirety in a variety of different editions. They start out relatively simple and end up becoming this complex saga of what's going on at the North Pole. And there's the North Polar Bear, and there's goblins. There's Father Christmas, and you have this sort of fantastic story illustrated in all sorts of clever ways. And in it, of course, we have Father Christmas in a story with, you know, goblins and the talking bears and things. And so you look at that and you think, well, this is very Narnia-esque. Why did he object? and I racked my brains over that. And I think I came up with a couple of thoughts on that. Actually, one of them, another thought, has to do with what we were talking about earlier, because he starts these letters very early when his children are very young, when John is very young. And so he's just being more playful, and he's not thinking about consistency. He's already set it up, and he just kind of runs with it. But I think the fact that these were letters that were for his family, as opposed to intentionally composed for a wider audience, gives him a freedom to be playful that I think he would have considered it as not the same thing if he were intentionally publishing them. Although it is interesting that he was very careful about preserving the letters. Mm-hmm. And I do wonder if he had in mind that they would eventually be published, because he didn't allow them to be lost or destroyed, even though they apparently would occasionally end up in the children's toy box, and he would rescue them and put them back in their brown envelope. And then the other thing I think is notable is that in his world of the Father Christmas letters, it's connected with our own world. There's a Father Christmas because there's Christ. And one of the things that struck me, that this is obscured in all of the editions of the Father Christmas letters. They write it out as Father with a full word, Christmas. Mm-hmm. Even the ones that give transcriptions of his handwriting in like facing pages, they all spell it out. But if you actually look at the images of the letters, most of the time, he uses the abbreviation FR mm-hmm. for father, which is the priestly abbreviation.
Yeah.
He uses that very, very often. And I think that's a really interesting detail. He's almost making the character Father Christmas into a priest figure, more like, you know, St. Nicholas, who was a bishop, you know. So this is a kind of a way that he's anchoring this Father Christmas figure into the actual world of his faith. And it gets obscured because of the way that it has been silently amended. And I'm quite disappointed with the emendations, even in the transcriptions. That to me is almost literary malpractice. Like, if it's transcriptions, you put what it actually is and not silently expand it. And I think that's another indication that when he's doing this, he's not making the world of Father Christmas a secondary world with his own rules. He's imagining it as an extension, a kind of a playful extension of the real world. And mm-hmm. I think that gives Tolkien kind of the imaginative sort of license that he needs to get over the consistency problem. But of course, Narnia is supposed to be a consistent world, or at least Tolkien would have assumed that it would be.
And even the Father Christmas myth, as in the one that he's interacting with, it is kind of loosey-goosey to begin with, because mm-hmm. what's your canon? What are the set rules here? You know, he's not St. Nicholas, but he's at the North Pole. Okay, where does that come from? Basically, how much are we drawing from Coca-Cola, and how much are we drawing from the Bishop of Myra?
Right. Good point. Yeah, you know, in all of this, I come back to, you know, okay, so I think we've established, like, yes, Tolkien, maybe not so much a fan of Narnia. You know, these were not his these were not necessarily his cup of tea, but it's maybe not as controversial as it at first seems, because we know that he was a big fan of so much of other things that Lewis did even before it. So, you know, we look back at all this and we say, oh, well, a guy wasn't a fan of something that one of his friends wrote. Like, that's not the first time that's happened. Maybe we're making a little bit too big of a deal about this. And he has some interesting reasons which reflect the work that he did on in his own works. But I think it's important at the end of the day always to remember that these two, like I said at the beginning of the episode, had such a profound influence on one another over the course of their lives. There was this incredible give and take. And I think it's so fascinating that even now, like, we're in the next year going to taste the, like, kind of a full fruition in some sense. Now there's, you know, it's going to be an interesting time, but there's, in some sense, we're going to taste the full fruition of this friendship with the, you know, full telling of this Numenorean legend, right? Which we might not have. In fact, we likely wouldn't have if it hadn't been for their friendship, because it was a challenge between the two of them. Jack, you're going to write the space story, and I'm going to write the time travel story. And that time travel story, Tolkien never really, like, it never really panned out as a time travel story, but it was the root of the Numenorean myth that worked its way into Middle Earth. And so, you know, I think it's easy for us to get hung up on, like, the sensational headline of, like, Tolkien despised Narnia, and lose sight of the fact that, like, they had this incredible friendship, and it's given us so much, so many amazing works of literature, both fiction and really nonfiction.
And I do think it's kind of funny that both of us, myself and Holly, have participated in debates of who is better, Lewis or Tolkien. Separately, naturally, I went with Lewis, and naturally, Holly, you know, chose the second choice. But this is exactly the point. And this is the heart of Dr. Goliath's work. And I would say anybody that really loves either Lewis or Tolkien, you can't read them for very long without seeing the profound influence that they had on each other. And that is kind of a legitimate argument, which is best. Well, you could pretty much say that, well, we wouldn't have one without the other.
Yeah. And even the debate that I did, which was so much fun, and Michael Ward took the Lewis side, and we had fun with it. Because, of course, we both love the other figure, and we both write about both figures. And so I felt that it was very much an inkling spirit, because we we threw in a lot of jokes. We were playfully kind of, you know, ribbing each other about it. You know, I was making fun of the fact, I mean, your guy's named Clive. I mean, come on.
Excuse me, Rule? What kind of name is that?
Well, see, exactly. So we had this playfulness about it. And I think that's the spirit to approach any of these questions of, you know, better. Because you, that inkling spirit, I think they would love that. But that's a different thing than actually trying to say one really is, you know, better than the other. They're doing different things in different ways. And as you said, you know, it's such a profound friendship. And it's, you know, and kind of going back, you know, it's something I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, that there's also this myth that, you know, that the alleged hatred of Narnia, you know, damaged their friendship. And there is a myth out there, I'm sure you've heard this as well, David, that you know, that they had a break in their friendship. And I just think that's hogwash. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now that I've spent a good part of my academic career teaching full time, and I think that part of Tolkien's life and Lewis's life is underappreciated. It's a lot of work to be in a university. They had a lot to do. And Tolkien especially was on loads of committee meetings. They just had a lot. They had a lot to do, especially as they got older. Tolkien had four children. They both had, you know, major academic careers and writing, and for Lewis speaking. They just didn't have as much time to just hang out as they did when they were bachelors, you know, back in the day. And that's just called life. It doesn't mean that they iced, you know, each other out. It just means they were busy men. And we see in the very end, you know, of how hard Tolkien worked to get Lewis the chair of literature at Cambridge. I mean, he went all out to do that, and you don't do that for somebody that you've cooled off from. So I think we got to, you know, along with laying the rest, the myth that Tolkien hated Narnia, let's put a stake in the heart of the idea that they that they had a, you know, a bust up of their friendship, because I don't think they did.
Yeah, when I was last in North Carolina, we had a whiskey with Douglas Gresham, Lewis's stepson, mm-hmm. and he retold the story of when he was visiting Lewis in the hospital and bumped into Tolkien on his way out. Tolkien was going to go and visit his friend, and things didn't look good for Lewis at that time. And one of the things that Tolkien said to him is, "You will always have a place to stay with us."
Mm. Yeah. Beautiful. And a great note to end on. Holly, David, this has been a delightful conversation. It really has a lot of fun. I love kind of digging into the life stories, the histories, the works of both of these individuals. Both have meant a lot to me in my life, and it's clear they've meant a lot to both of you as well. So this has been a lot of fun.
I'm here.
Thanks for joining me. So that's all for this episode, and thank you to our amazing patrons, especially the following: Andrew T, John R, Ms. Anonymous, Red Hawk, Caitlin of T with Tolkien, Shannon S, Brian O, Emilio P, Zeke F, James A, James L, Chris L, Chuck F, Azia V, Ish of the Hammer, Teresa C, David of Pints with Jack, Jonathan D, Eric S, Eric B, Johanna T, Mike M, Robert H, Paul D, Julia, and Worty, as well as those celebrating their patron anniversary in November, Matthew F and James. Thanks for listening, everybody, and we will talk at you next time. Bye-bye.